So our reading will be Job 2. I'll just give the band a minute. Job 2. On another day, the angels came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came with them to present himself before him. And the Lord said to Satan, "Where have you come from?" Satan answered the Lord, "From roaming throughout the earth, going back and forth on it." Then the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? There is no one on earth like him. He is blameless and upright, a man who fears God and shuns evil. And he still maintains his integrity, though you incited me against him to ruin him without any reason." "Skin for skin," Satan replied. "A man will give all he has for his own life. But now stretch out your hand and strike his flesh and bones, and he will surely curse you to your face." The Lord said to Satan, "Very well then, he is in your hands, but you must spare his life." So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord and afflicted Job with painful sores from the soles of his feet to the crown of his head. Then Job took a piece of broken pottery and scraped himself with it as he sat among the ashes. His wife said to him, "Are you still maintaining your integrity? Curse God and die." He replied, "You are talking like a foolish woman. Shall we accept good from God and not trouble?" In all this, Job did not sin in what he said. When Job's three friends, Eliphaz the Temanite, Bildad the Shuhite, and Zophar the Naamathite, heard about all the troubles that had come upon him, they set out from their homes and met together by agreement to go and sympathize with him and comfort him. When they saw him from a distance, they could hardly recognize him. They began to weep aloud, and they tore their robes and sprinkled dust on their heads. Then they sat on the ground with him for 7 days and seven nights. No one said a word to him because they saw how great his suffering was.
Well, before we approach this challenging passage, let's pray. Father, you've told us that your word is a lamp to our feet and a light to our path. We confess, Lord, that sometimes we know the path you want us to walk, but we know it's dark, and we don't want to. Father, we pray this morning that your word would inspire us, that it would make that path less scary for us, that it would strengthen our resolve, and that we'd go out from here as people willing to walk it. Amen. Amen. So if you were here last week, quite a lot of that reading you've just heard is going to feel quite familiar. There's that scene in God's throne room. The angels present themselves before God. God has a discussion with Satan, or the Satan, the opponent. Satan makes a challenge. Suffering is inflicted on Job. So last week, Sam really focused in on how Job reacts to his suffering. And again, that's actually something that's very similar in this week's passage. So we are going to touch on it, but we're not going to focus on that this morning. In future weeks in this series, we'll come back to Job and we'll dig much deeper into how he feels and how he responds to God. So what we are going to do this morning is we're going to spend a bit more time on some other issues that come up in this passage that weren't there last week. And that can give us a fuller understanding of a Christian response to suffering. So if we take this separately from chapter 1, chapter 2 is all about reaction. So what we're going to do is we're going to consider each of the reactions that we see in this passage, and we're going to work through what does that teach us about suffering and about how we should respond. Okay? So we're going to start off with the cosmic perspective, as we did last week, the scene in God's throne room, and this conversation between God and Satan. God talks to Satan about Job, verse 3, and he says the exact same thing as he said in chapter 1, word for word. "There's no one on earth like Job. He's blameless and upright." And then he tags on this additional bit at the back end of verse 3. "Still, Job maintains his integrity. though you incited me against him to ruin him without any reason. This is a reminder, this is a recap of what happened in chapter 1. Satan very confidently said to God, well, okay, sure, he's upright, but look at everything you've given him. Of course he loves you. Look at all the stuff. He's rich. He's comfortable. Take that away. Then we'll see. He'll lose his faith. So God allowed it to happen. He allowed everything Job had, his family, of course, most importantly, and his livelihood to be taken from him. And yet, end of verse 1, Job did not sin by charging God with wrongdoing. Job did not blame God. Job did not lose his faith. And this is God reminding Satan that Satan was wrong. Satan said he could break Job, and he was wrong. He said that Job's faith wouldn't stand up to suffering, and he was wrong. He said that Job loved God for what God could give him rather than who God is, and he was wrong. And what we see here in verse 4, the first reaction in our passage is Satan's reaction to how that all played out. And maybe this won't surprise you, it probably shouldn't, if I'm honest, but it turns out that Satan is one of those people. I suspect we all know people like this. I know one or two. If you play a game with them, you might think you've won. But then they'll tell you that, well, at home we play by the proper rules, so this didn't really count. Or maybe they could have made a move a little while ago and then they'd have won, but they didn't want to upset you. Or they always meant it to be best of three, actually, or you get the point. If they win, they win. If they lose, it's worse, because then you have to sit there while they change it all around, and then they win. That's what Satan's trying to do here, verses 4 and 5. Does he say, well, okay, fine, he passed the test? No. There's no acknowledgement that he was wrong. There's no acknowledgement that Job's faith actually was incredibly impressive to stand up to the trial that he went through. My goodness. But he just tries to reframe it. God allowed Satan in chapter 1 to take away everything Job had, everything, except his health. So, of course, Satan says, well, if you give a man a choice between his health and everything else, he'll choose his health every time, skin for skin. So I meant his health all along. Obviously, all of the other stuff was just irrelevant. Strike Job's flesh and bones, God, take his health, then he'll curse you to your face. That's what I meant. That's the real quiz. I think our reaction, if we read this slowly, if we really try to feel it, it's just not fair. It's not fair. After everything that Job went through in chapter 1, he lost his children. He lost everything that he had to support himself with. That is loss on a scale that I hope none of us ever has to imagine. Surely he's been through enough. Surely, whatever purpose his suffering has served, surely that's done. But that is not how Satan sees it. And that is not how Satan reacts. He doesn't admit he was wrong. He doesn't accept that he's lost. He doesn't accept that the purpose of that suffering has been served. That was just round one. Here comes round two. Because Satan doesn't play fair. There's a reason why it's a cliche that bad news comes in threes. This is a tactic. He'll bombard us sometimes with misery after misery after misery. When we're suffering, when we're going through something, maybe better times are around the corner. Or maybe they're not. Maybe there's more suffering around the corner. So that's why Job's reaction in chapter 1 is so perfect. And that's why he's the example that we're all encouraged to follow. When we suffer, when some aspect of our lives takes a hit, it's a natural reaction to focus on what we still have. Seeing what happens to Job in chapter 1, how could you not sympathize? It's horrific what he goes through. But I think the non-Christian perspective would, at some point, include saying to him, well, at least you've got your health. At least you're still here. You can still expect to live. It might not be soon, and it might not be much, but you have happiness to look forward to. And it might be true. It might be true when we say that, but can you now see the danger of that worldly perspective? Satan hasn't finished with Job after everything that happens to him in chapter 1. As gargantuan as the scale of that is, that's not the end. His reaction to how Job deals with suffering is more suffering. So if what was getting Job through it was, at least I've got my health, if that's what gets him through chapter 1, he would be in serious trouble in chapter 2, right? Fortunately for Job, that isn't what gets him through. And this is the example, this is the model, this is the thing that we must try to aspire to. Chapter 1, verse 21, we read it a few times last week. We can really never hear this too much. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. May the name of the Lord be praised. Job's trust in God, Job's acknowledgement that God is in control, is 100%. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Or, to stop borrowing from last week's passage, you get the same sentiment at the back end of verse 10. In chapter 2, shall we accept good from God and not trouble? Same thing. God is in control. And that's what gets Job through the suffering we saw last week. It's what gets Job through the suffering we see this week. He believes absolutely and without question that God is in control. Sometimes God will give and sometimes he'll take. Sometimes he'll give good and sometimes he'll give trouble. But that's always God doing it. God is always in control. That's the perspective that gets Job through. Now, we said last week, Job's basically right, but sometimes wrong. He's a little bit wrong here, and we can see that because we see the cosmic perspective. It's not God who takes. It's not God who gives trouble. It's Satan that's doing those things, right? But Satan does have to ask God's permission before he can inflict the suffering on Job. God doesn't take. He's slightly wrong there, but God does allow Satan to take. God doesn't give trouble, but he allows Satan to give trouble. So although he's a little bit wrong, Job's perspective is right. God's control is absolute. God's control of the taking, God's control of the trouble is perfect. In chapter 1, God puts a limit on it. You can take everything, all the stuff that Job has, but you can't damage his health, and so it goes. This week, yes, okay, you can damage his health, but you can't kill him. And so it goes. So even though Satan takes, even though Satan gives trouble, God's control, his sovereignty, is absolutely complete, even over the suffering that he allows Satan to inflict on Job. As we keep going through the book over the rest of the series, we're going to dig more deeply into why a God who loves us would allow that, would permit it within his absolute control. But for now, the lesson to learn is, although Job gets the details a little wrong, his perspective is absolutely right. Whether God is giving or allowing Satan to take, whether he's giving us good or allowing Satan to give us trouble, God is in control. That's the perspective, Job's perspective. Although we might not know the reason in this life for what we're going through, we do know, we must know, that God's purpose is being served because God is controlling it. Keeping that truth close to his heart is what gets Job through, because it's the only thing that Satan can't take from him. If his health gets him through, Satan can take it. But that truth, Satan cannot take away. And it's the same for us. Anything else we lean on when we suffer might be the next thing to go. That is the sad reality of life. But if we can, and I'm not for a second suggesting that this is easy, but if we can believe as Job believes, that God is totally sovereign, that anything that's happening to us, blow after blow, is being allowed to happen because of God's great purposes, and that God's purposes matter more than anything else, well, then that's going to get us through. That can't be taken from us. Satan might come back for round 2 or 3 or 4, if God allows it. But if we're clinging to that truth that God is sovereign, that even this serves his purpose, then we will come through it. So that's our lesson personally for when we suffer, based on how we see Satan reacting in this passage. The other reactions in the passage are about how other people react to Job's suffering. And actually, the lessons that we learn here are for how we would react when other people are suffering, rather than when we are. And I think we can find in the passage two examples of things not to do, and one good example of a thing to do. So verse 7, just to return us to the narrative for a second, Job is struck with these sores from head to toes. Verse 8, he's scratching himself with a piece of broken pottery just to get some relief from the pain. He's in total misery. And although it's maybe not immediately obvious, the first reaction is actually in this verse. Where is Job when he's doing this? When he's scratching himself, he's sitting among the ashes. It's a reference that maybe wouldn't be clear to us, but to the original readers it would have been. We don't know a lot about the land of Uz, where all of this takes place, but from the various references, shaving heads as a sign of grief, Chaldean raiders, all that kind of thing, we can be relatively comfortable that it's somewhere in where the rest of the Old Testament takes place. It's somewhere near the Arabian Peninsula, and it's probably within the time frame of Genesis. It's quite a big time frame, to be fair. So the way that people in that region during that time dealt with rubbish, right, food waste, that kind of thing, they take it away from where everyone lived, outside of the town or settlement, and they would burn it. Which makes a lot of sense, actually, when you think about it. The waste they had was mostly organic stuff, mostly old food and that kind of thing. In a hot climate, that's going to decay. If you keep it around people, they're going to get sick. So they take the waste away from people and they burn it up. And that controls the health risk. Quite clever. So that phrase, among the ashes, signifies that Job was at the place where they burned the rubbish. That's the ashes. It's what's left over of the rubbish. So this verse is telling us Job's at the dump. Job's outside the town. Job is well away from people. Now, there's nothing in this passage that tells us that society forced him out, although personally I think that's the most likely thing. Maybe he went there on his own, but if he did, we can say that nobody in this passage, nobody in this book, actually comes out and says, hey, Job, come back to where the people are. It's okay. And that's our first bad reaction to somebody who's suffering. We might get some hints as we go through the rest of the book as to why people might not have wanted to be around somebody who was going through the things that Job was. And a lot of those reasons, I'm happy to say, don't apply in modern society. They're attitudes that have changed. But, I do think we still have a tendency to avoid people when they're having a hard time. We might not see people who are grieving or struggling in their lives and force them to go and live at the Letchworth Recycling Centre, because who can remember the opening hours? But we might find that we phone them a little bit less. We might find that when we see them at the tea and coffee time, we steer slightly in the other direction. We might find that if we spot them across the supermarket or in the town centre, we're ducking that conversation. We might find that when we do speak to them, we just avoid talking about the thing they're going through, taking their mind off it, right? That's good for people. And we might tell ourselves that that's because we don't want to overwhelm them. We don't want to remind them of their pain. We're taking their mind off it. We're giving them some space. But fundamentally, if we're honest, it's just slightly selfish. You can't be that close to someone in pain without feeling some pain. If you were there in us, if you were among the ashes, imagine speaking to Job now. Imagine standing and talking to a man who's lost his children, who's lost his possessions, and has now been struck with these sores. How could you possibly not feel some pain as you have that conversation? And to some extent, that's true of everyone. Of course, what we feel is only a fraction of what they feel, but we still suffer a bit. when we get close to people. We still suffer a bit when we engage with other people's suffering. And if we limit it, if we just keep it slightly further away, it's easier for us, if we're honest. But of course, the easy thing isn't the right thing. Sure, we're not sending people out to live at the dump, but it's going to feel like that. They're going to feel like they're cut off from people, like they can't be there. And that's, I hope it's clear, a wrong reaction. When we see people suffering, we shouldn't send them to the dump. We shouldn't avoid them. We shouldn't cut down on contact. So that's our first wrong reaction. The second one is in verse 9, a little more obvious. Job's wife tells him bluntly that now is the time to curse God after everything he's been through. I think on one level, Job's wife represents the world's view. I think that's what she's doing here. If God exists, but still there's suffering, well then, God must be too weak. Or God must not care. Or maybe God's a bit evil, and he likes to see people suffering. And if you're suffering right now, well, that proves it. Blame him. It's his fault. You're going to find that view out there absolutely everywhere. It's in the media, it's in non-Christian family and friends and neighbours. We may know people within the church who have struggled with that when they've lived through tragedy. We may be people who have struggled with that. Again, I'm probably not going to shock you here, but let's say out loud, it's not a reaction that we should have. It's a reaction we should try to avoid. We've had a glimpse behind the scenes, right? And we know this is what Satan wants. He wants Job to deny his faith and renounce God because he suffered too much to put his trust in God. Verse 5, if God allows Job's health to suffer, then Job surely will curse God to his face. Verse 9, his wife encourages him to do exactly that thing. She's encouraging him to do exactly what Satan wants. You can't get much clearer in the Bible that that's a bad thing, that that's a wrong reaction. So I think there's a slightly more subtle point that gets overlooked when we look at this passage, which is less about what Job's wife does, because that I think is obvious, but more about why she does it. It's easy to lose focus, right? It's the book of Job. It's about Job and Job. But look at what Job says in verse 10. Look at the end there. Shall we accept good from God and not trouble? Not shall I accept good, shall we accept good. What happened to Job in chapter 1? He lost his children. Job's wife lost her children. Job lost every means he had to make money to feed his family. Job's wife lost every prospect of being fed. All of that pain, all of the suffering that we've been thinking about Job going through, and of course it's right that we should, his wife's gone through every bit of it as well. So yes, she comes to Job and tells him to curse God. She's doing that in the depths of her own grief. She's doing that in her own suffering. She's grieving her children. She's worried about how they're going to feed themselves. And now she's seen her husband fall ill with these sores. I actually wonder if Job might be acknowledging that when he says that she's talking like a foolish woman. We see people in the Bible rebuking each other directly, right? And not subtly. People don't feel the need to sort of couch it at all. It wouldn't look out of place at all if Job had said, "You are a foolish woman." But he doesn't. I wonder if he's expressing it that way to show us that he understands she's not herself, that her grief to some extent is speaking. And that doesn't mean that what she says isn't wrong. It is wrong. It's exactly what Satan wants. That's as wrong as it gets. But I don't think it's a stretch to say that some of the reason why she gets it wrong is because she's been overwhelmed by her own emotion rather than because she's setting out to do evil. So yes, of course, when people are suffering, we shouldn't encourage them to turn their backs on God. Let's learn this lesson. But more broadly, if we're trying to help people who are suffering, we must be careful of our own emotions. We mustn't let our emotions trip us up. Again, easier to say than to do. If you're as close to something as Job's wife is, then, of course, we'll be overwhelmed by our own emotions. And actually, it might be that the best thing for us to do is just agree not to make any big decisions until the immediate pain has passed. But actually, when we're coming from the outside, we might find ourselves getting triggered, I think the word is these days, as well. Sometimes things will strike a nerve. It might be that the thing that's causing the suffering is an issue that's particularly emotional for us. Or it might be that the way that somebody is behaving is making us angry, because sometimes it will. It's going to be hard to avoid those reactions, and it's important that we recognize them. We can see from this example, when our own emotions take over, we do risk getting it badly wrong. So when we can't help it, perhaps that's the time for us to take a more cautious approach. So those are the two reactions to avoid. Let's wrap up with a reaction that's a good example for us. If you're familiar with Job, this one might surprise you. Actually, this week, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar are our example to follow. It was bound to happen at some point. As Sam said last week, they are basically wrong, but they get some things right. And this is one of those times, verse 11. They hear the news about Job. It's implied that they're some way off. And they go to him. They go to him. The opposite of what we saw earlier. Job's society is happy for him to live at the dump. If they didn't force him out, they're not going out to get him back. These guys, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar, they show up. They come from afar. They draw near. And when they get there, verses 12 and 13, they do the things that people did when they were in mourning. They tear their clothes. They put dust on their heads. They weep. And they sit with him for a week, saying nothing. Just mourning with him. What a powerful picture that is. Of people drawing near to somebody who's grieving and just sharing, just being there, just showing him that he's not alone. They're clearly overwhelmed by their emotions. We don't know what they were planning to do, but it tells us at the end of the passage there that they didn't speak because they couldn't, because they were overwhelmed. And so wisely, they just sit silent then, but they're there. In Paul's letter to the Romans, that's the reaction that he recommends. Mourn with those who mourn. And Jesus himself, when he saw Lazarus's sister and friends mourning because Lazarus had died, before he did the thing that he famously did with Lazarus, Jesus wept. It's not to say that we should only sympathize with people when they're suffering. Of course, there will always be a place for practical help, for the meal train, for getting shopping, for going along with people when they've got something difficult to do, for praying, for all of the other things. Of course there will. But what a great reminder. Yes, we can do the practical things. But as well as that, what an incredible support it can be for our brothers and sisters, for our families, for our friends, if we simply draw near and share in the grief. When they feel alone, we can go and sit in the dump with them. When others are pulling back, we can pull closer. When it would be easy to get away, carried away with our own emotion, we can instead sympathize with theirs. We're saying this a lot already in this series, and I'm sure it's going to come up again. These are hard things to do. These are incredibly hard things to do at an incredibly difficult time to remember these lessons. It's so hard. It's hard to draw near. It's hard to control our emotions. It's hard to let people know we're sorry for what they're going through and have it be real and not just a thing that you say. Why do we do it? Because this is what Jesus does. Psalm 23, I just picked an example, there are lots, tells us that the rod and staff of the good shepherd comfort us where? In the valley. In the valley of the shadow of death. Jesus doesn't wait at the other side of the valley and say, there are good times ahead. I'll be here. Pop on out. He walks through the valley with us, side by side. He comforts us. Even in the deepest, darkest times. So when it's hard, when it's tricky to mourn with those who mourn, when we'd rather not get too close, when our own emotions are boiling over, let's fix our eyes on Jesus, on our perfect comforter, and aspire to his example.